You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas E. or Tom Woods Jr. is an American historian, political analyst, and author. And he is he's a New York Times best-selling author. His most recent book, Real Descent, which we're going to talk about, and a book that I really loved as well, How the Catholic Church Built Civilization. I think you've published 11 books, sir. 11 books. And you know what bothers me about that? You're 5 years younger than I am. So I think that's disrespectful. Let me just start with that.
Well, you know, I'm just going to rub salt in the wound. It's 12 now.
That's an outrage, sir. I mean, this is already turning into
an assault on your ego?
An assault on my ego. Thank you. You identify as a libertarian, and you're a proponent of the Austrian School of Economics. And for what it's worth, I am too. But I bet I'm not as articulate in advocating for a libertarian point of view. I just believe in maximum personal liberty and personal responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. I want to get into – I'm not sure where to start. Well, how do you want to start? I want to talk – I guess – I thought your book on how the Catholic Church built Western civilization. First of all, that's a pretty controversial title. And I was always – you know, I was always taught, take the road to Athens, not the road to Jerusalem. In other words, be a man of reason, not a man of faith. Reason is what builds everything. Reason is the reason that I can push myself beyond my biology. This is the reason I have a cell phone that works and I can talk to people far away. You make the argument, in fact, that if it weren't for the Catholic Church, which is grounded in reason in many ways, and a rich intellectual tradition, it gave us, my gosh, our agriculture to an extent. It gave us a lot of our science. You argue that we wouldn't have these things if it wasn't for the Catholic Church.
Well, I'm saying that a major ingredient in building Western civilization is the church in a lot of areas in which most people think the church was probably just some kind of medieval obstacle, just getting in the way, trying to prevent the advance of knowledge and all that. And I understand why people think that. I mean, I learned that in school. It's perfectly normal that people would think that. But if you actually consult, and this is anybody can do this, consult a mainstream historian of science in the 21st century, and almost any of them will tell you, yeah, we don't believe that old myth about the church was the enemy of science anymore. We see there's a much richer picture here. And it would be a little odd if the most influential institution in Western civilization, if the scientific revolution had occurred completely in spite of that thing. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe. So I spend probably in that church on that book on how the Catholic Church built Western civilization. The longest chapter is the science chapter because I know I got a long row to hoe, as they say, on that one, because I have so many skeptical people reading that. But as I say, what I'm really doing in there is citing books, you know, books published by Cambridge University Press, Oxford, to show that the mainstream of academia now is saying that, well, to the contrary, actually, it seems like there are certain Catholic theological ideas that lent themselves to the scientific revolution. There were a whole lot of Jesuits who participated in the scientific revolution. And you go on down the list, and a lot of what we thought we knew is overturned. In fact, just the other day on my podcast, is a libertarian podcast, the Tom Woods Show, but the other day I did a show called Am I a Dummy for Believing in God? Because it's sort of fashionable to go around saying, you know, I know some of you people need faith, but doggone it, I'm a scientist.
Well, we had Lawrence Krauss on this podcast, and I was kind of like, I was citing Karen Armstrong's book, Case for God, and he wouldn't even let me finish the sentence. The guy was just like, it's right. Just a bunch of peasants that wrote some book. Science is vast, and, you know, yeah.
So what I did on my show this week, just because I'm a libertarian, I have a lot of libertarians listening to me, and they are totally divided on the issue of God. And I have a lot of the kind of teenage atheist types who, I haven't read anything, but I ain't going to do what anybody tells me to do kind of attitude. And if you believe in God, you might as well believe in the flying spaghetti monster and all that. So I had a whole episode where I said, look, I'm just going to tell you one of the five arguments Thomas Aquinas made. And we're going to go through it point by point, and you'll see he's not referring to the Bible. He's not saying, you've got to believe in God because it says right here on page 12. No. He goes through step by step, he shows you, he makes an argument, and then at the end of the argument he says, now that we know that God exists, and now that we know this thing about him, Now I can show you why God has to be just one, why he has to be all-powerful, why he has to be outside of time. So in other words, when somebody like Richard Dawkins, who's a very fashionable atheist, although his own colleagues have called him an embarrassment to the new atheism out there, but Dawkins even says in his book, The God Delusion, you know, look, even if we accept that Thomas Aquinas accurately and persuasively proves the existence of God, he never tells us why this God has to be only one or all-powerful. You know, why couldn't this God be Zeus or Apollo or the flying spaghetti monster? And the thing is, Aquinas spends hundreds of pages on this subject. Dawkins doesn't even know this.
Wow.
So yeah. I did this on my show, and of course the response was right down the middle. Some people saying, wow, I never heard this before. I've never been exposed to this. I just thought you had to be a credulous idiot to be a religious believer. And then I had other people who it wouldn't have mattered what I said. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have mattered
sure.
if I myself were God and I transformed before them into some, you know, like whatever. It wouldn't have made
right,
no
right.
difference.
But the argument you're making is that Aquinas used a lot of logic, didn't he? Like the
yeah.
primary mover, kind of like the way our I think it was Aristotle. I mean, there were a lot of logical explanations for the way. I mean, he spent a lot of time thinking about this in a logical way, I guess is what we're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I only took one. I mean, there are five so-called five ways that Thomas Aquinas used, but I took one of them and I gave a lot of real-world examples to show that we all recognize that when one thing changes into another thing, or when anything changes, something on the outside is doing the changing. And
right.
once you come to see that, believe it or not, you are on the path to seeing that there has to be a God.
There was a primary mover.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we don't even mean motion in the physical sense of going from A to B. They mean motion in the sense, A to B is an example, but even when your dinner goes from being cold to being hot, in
yeah.
Aristotle's language, that's a kind of motion. The dinner doesn't enhotinate itself, right? it is made hot by another.
Yes.
And once you recognize that, it's only three or four more steps before you say, whoa, wait a minute, hold on a minute. We are treading on dangerous ground here. I may have to admit there's a God.
How does that, and in fact, then you talk about how important the monks were in not only keeping traditions alive, but also in perfecting things like metallurgy. They were very, very involved in the everyday, tangible, materialistic world because it was difficult, hard work. It was cleansing for their soul as far as they were concerned.
Right.
But yeah. And I thought that was kind of interesting, the power of a group of men in isolated pockets who are trying to live this, I guess, life of faith and purity as best they could, and what an influence it had on the rest of the world.
Well, and so I've got a chapter in there, indeed, on the contribution of the monks. And you would think, well, what possible contribution could these people make? They're living in isolation. They're living in an isolated community. But after the Roman Empire falls and the various barbarian kingdoms create a patchwork of barbarianism in Western Europe, a lot of the arts of, well, making a lot of different types of things get lost. And so the monks have to reteach these things, whether it's irrigation or agriculture or the keeping of bees or the brewing of beer or the raising of fruit or breeding animals or making champagne or all these sorts of things, because there's no one else to do it. And even if a barbarian group sacks one monastery, it doesn't matter, because there are 1,400 others, in each one of which is self-sufficient with its own little factories and its own little community.
And they
so
shared information. And they shared information, didn't they?
And
there
they
was a
communicated
lot of,
with
yeah.
each other, and they disseminate knowledge throughout Europe. And in fact, the university system was created around the late 12th, early 13th century. So, I mean, the university system is like the great gift to the world of the Middle Ages. And yet most people would think, oh, the Middle Ages, wow, it must have just been a whole lot of superstition. But I don't think most professors today could have withstood the rigor of a medieval university where you had to be on your toes. You had to be doing debates in the afternoon. Your views were constantly being challenged. You know, whereas a lot of professors, I think, spend their time blogging all day.
Well, wasn't that also a function of Charlemagne is given credit? I have heard lectures that Charlemagne was given credit for creating the university system, not creating, but at least starting it. And his conversion, I think, and you touch on it in the book, he was so impressed with these sort of quote-unquote Christians that were just volunteering in hospitals and on battlefields and just giving their charity, giving their time and risking their lives at times just to take care of people in the name of this God. And that was sort of what was part of his conversion, wasn't it?
Well, there are a number of stories of people whose heroic witness, we might call it, led to the conversion of others, like all the way back, go back even farther than that to the Roman Empire and the Roman soldiers who would be persecuting the Christians. Like that was what they were supposed to do. And yet these Christians would be helping them during a plague or praying for them. And, you know, and after a while you say, well, why are they being so nice to me when I'm not really being that nice to them?
It's amazing how powerful that is, right?
And then with Charlemagne, with Charlemagne, he starts he orders that schools be established around the major cathedrals. And then in later centuries, in some cases, the universities develop out of these early cathedral schools. So sometimes you just plant a small seed and it really blossoms.
Mm.
Well, and I mean, that's the thing. Funnily enough, this sort of segues into real dissent, because that's how you win hearts and minds, is by being nice to people rather than by invading their countries.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Good segue.
Thanks.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah. So book number 12 is this one called Real Dissent. The idea of it is that we don't really have a lot of real dissent. We have fake arguments on TV between, you know, cable TV commentators who all share the same basic premise. They're just bickering over the details. Or if you watch a Democratic Party presidential debate or Republican presidential debate, I mean, what do they disagree on? I mean, very, very little, except for a guy like Ron Paul. He comes along, he disagrees with them on everything, and at least it makes it interesting.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that we need more of that. We need more real dissent. Instead of saying that, well, here's the U.S. foreign policy. It's going to be, we're either going to bomb this country or we're going to try to starve them to death. So go ahead and pick one of those. Real dissent would be, you know what, maybe we don't have to do either of these.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm all about here. That we have this artificially restricted range of debate that the New York Times graciously allows us to engage in, but I want to throw over the table here. You know, I don't want to go by the rules of the New York Times. The New York Times hates me. Why would I want to follow their rules?
I love that. But distinguish for us, explain to us, you are not a neoconservative.
Good God, no.
Far from it.
But you were at one point, as you say in the book.
I was, and of course the neoconservatives are the people who are most responsible for the current U.S. foreign policy.
Yep.
And they are the ones that when people are listening to right-wing radio on the radio, I mean, 99.9% of them are neoconservatives.
Yep.
Which means they favor a very, very belligerent sort of foreign policy, and it means also that, in my experience, the vast bulk of them don't know very much about what it actually means to be a conservative. Like an actual conservative would think, you know, going over to the Middle East and trying to take ancient cultures and turn them into Woodrow Wilson-style Western democracies is probably not a conservative project.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Are you saying that Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz didn't know much about Arab culture? That's an outrage, sir.
I know it. I know. And they actually know nothing, as it turns out, about what conservatism is all about. And the thing is, I was duped by these people. You know, when I was a high school kid, all I knew was I didn't like the Democrats. All right, so I was half right. You know, I didn't like the Democrats. So I thought, well, then I guess I must be a Rush Limbaugh guy. So I listened to Rush, and I pretty much just adopted whatever he said. I didn't know any better, and I be honest with you, I wasn't creative enough to think of my own independent thoughts, so I just believed all these things. And then it just suddenly dawned on me that, well, not just dawned on me, I actually encountered some people who really were conservative or really were libertarian, and they were saying, no, these people, I mean, they're all in love with the government at one level or another. The Democrats have their preferences of things they want government to do, and the neocons have all these other crazy impossibilities they want government to carry out. Maybe there's another alternative, right? Maybe you don't have to be this way. And I began to look at the foreign policy and say, well, this is counterproductive, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in the old days, like, I used to think that you would have to be some kind of pinko commie who hates America if you were at all worried about civilian casualties. Hey, what's the matter with you, you commie? We're going out and getting the bad guys.
But exactly.
That's not a healthy or productive way to think.
It doesn't work
at all. So I'm glad I'm out of that.
Yeah. Well, I happen to think there needs to be more of your thinking out there. What happened? I feel like the internet is creating more of a libertarian point of view among young people. Is there a trend to point to that? Is there good news here or is there bad news? I mean,
it's definitely because, you know, you could say, well, the internet gives everybody a louder voice than they had before. That's true. But before we had the internet, we already had the Democrat and Republican voices. We already had those.
Yeah.
And so now they're a little bit louder on the internet, but we didn't have our voice at all. And I'm not talking, by the way, about the Libertarian Party. I mean, I'm using Democrats and Republicans as shorthand, but typical liberals, typical conservatives, you know, whose views are conventional, I can predict everything that's going to come out of their mouths.
Yeah,
they have a presence on the internet too, but they had a presence already in society, whereas we're coming out of nowhere. And yeah, it's true that not every young person is interested, but increasingly they are interested, or at least a young person will be libertarian on two or three things.
Yes.
And then they look into those things, and they suddenly realize, well, maybe I'm actually libertarian on a couple of more things. And then once you start reading some of the greats, or you come across some of a really good libertarian podcast, that sort of thing, then
the,
before
for
you know
example,
it, you're
like
gone.
Tom Woods show.
Like the Tom Woods show, if I had to pick one at random.
Because I'm telling you right now, I'll be listening to your podcast. I don't listen to my podcast, but I will be listening to Tom Woods' podcast. Carry on. I'm a terrible marketer for my own stuff. But yeah. That's the other thing that I find as well, is when I try to explain to young people sort of the principles behind a libertarian philosophy, I think human beings are naturally libertarian. I mean, human beings want a say in who governs them. They want to be able to speak their mind. They want to be rewarded for their own ingenuity and hard work. The marketplace, usually, if left alone, has this wonderful ability to correct and right itself. I know that Paul Krugman would disagree with me on that. It's always amazing to me when I, like, Gail Collins was having a debate with Woods, what's his name from the New York Times? Woods, what's his, not Thomas Woods, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, and they were talking, and Gail Collins said, she essentially said she believed in more government spending and bigger government programs. And I was just like, how are you kind of writing for the New York Times? Haven't you learned some lessons? I'm not saying that there isn't a place for certain things, but it was just interesting that, you know, I almost don't hear so much of that anymore. I hear sort of, it's more of a nuanced argument about what role government plays. And I'm long-winded here, but let me ask you this question. To what extent should the government play a role in our lives? What percentage? Is there a percentage? I mean, what is a libertarian?
All right. Now listen, I have to preface this. I want everybody to understand you may have to block your ears for my answer.
I love it.
You might not be ready to hear my answer. And in fact, my answer would require a whole separate show to flesh out entirely.
We'll have
but
you
my
back.
Answer, yeah. My answer is actually zero. My answer used to be like 2 or 3%. But at this point, I've decided, you know, I just don't trust these SOBs with anything. And I also don't trust them when they keep telling me how much I need them. Maybe I don't, actually. And there's a liberating moment as a libertarian where you say, yeah, I believe in limited government, and government should just be kept limited to the small, insignificant functions of defense and law and courts and whatever, and of being able to tax to whatever degree they think is appropriate. But other than that, well, once you give them that, what's to keep them there? There's no particular incentive they would have to stay limited to that. And so invariably then they start doing this, they start doing that, they start spying on you, they start bombing people. It's hard to keep that genie in the bottle. It's hard to keep that toothpaste in the tube, basically.
Right.
So I belong to the wing of libertarianism. We are very much a minority, it's true.
You're an anarchist.
Yeah, but we have this really badass-sounding term, anarcho-capitalism. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Like, you hear it, you say to yourself, I don't care what that is. I want to be one of those.
Man, dude, I know. I was going to say, I might get a tattoo. I think I just found my first tattoo. But come on. Listen, you're radical, man. Tom Woods, I mean, I understand. You're young. You're a whippersnapper. You're only 42. But the bottom line is, we need some government. I mean, I need defense. I need hospitals. I need roads. I need public schools, sort of, for people that can't afford private schools. I need some kind of a net for the people that just can't take care of themselves. I know people that are just too fragile for the world. I don't want to see them starving on the street.
Yeah, that's true. No, I understand all that. Let's take it. There are a lot of different ways you could approach that. You could approach it by saying, well, we've done all these things without government. Like England became the most literate society on the face of the earth with no government schooling whatsoever. Secondly, in terms of education, if you look around the world, I've had James Tooley on my show, who'd be worth having on your show, by the way, who's an education researcher who's gone all over the world. He's gone to India, he's gone to China, he's gone all over the world. And the totally unbelievably untold story around the world in terms of education are all these private schools nobody knew existed that are low cost, that are educating the poor all over the world far better than the government schools are.
What a surprise.
And so I've had two guests on my show talking about low-cost private schools in the developing world. It's totally an untold story. Gee, I wonder why, right? You know, why would we not be told about this story?
Yeah.
But so if in the developing world you can get schools in the private sector that are one-third the cost and yet statistically vastly better in terms of output, then surely this can occur in this country. But then when it comes to other questions, I could shift into a more principled argument. I could say, you could say to me, Woods, I have a really, really worthwhile charity. Like, I mean, this is like so, so important. I've devoted my whole life to it. So I am going to reach into your wallet and take out a donation to my charity. Like, everybody in the world would say, well, you can't do that. I don't care how worthy your charity is. You can't do that. You can make the strongest appeal you want to me and everything, but you can't just take that. Like, everybody would know that.
Mm-hmm.
So the libertarian would say, well, what is the moral difference just because the government comes along and says, well, we have this really super-duper charity, namely ourselves, and we'd like to stick our hand in there. Like, it doesn't seem to be a moral difference, even if you say, but the government is backed by a majority of the population, which it rarely is because, you know, you get people who don't vote and all that. But even if they were backed by the majority of the population, what is the moral significance of a majority? I mean, if you and I go out for drinks and we're in a party of 10 and the other 9 of us vote that you should buy all the drinks, you don't have to buy all the drinks. Even though we all voted and you are way outvoted, you don't have to buy the drinks,
sure.
Right? So the point is that these principles that we recognize as being morally essential in our private lives continue to be morally essential in all aspects of life. I mean, that's the liberating breakthrough that turns you away from the state forever.
What would you do, though, about people that had no one to depend on? I mean, part of the reason that FDR came up with a lot of these programs or, you know, and people then, there had to be an answer. There were people who were on the street and who were old and had worked their ass off their whole life. There were people that just needed help. I mean, there are people that need real help. Whether
yeah.
they're a blind diabetic, like a woman that I know who just doesn't have money, man, and she has to, thank God she gets a stipend from the government. I don't know what would happen to her. She'd
right.
have to rely on people like, you know, frankly, myself, who would, you know, take pity on her. But I don't think anybody wants that either.
No, that's true. So we have to think this through. For one thing, we do a thought experiment, and we say, let's suppose every single government program to help people in various sorts of unfortunate situations somehow, for some reason, was abolished tomorrow.
Mm.
Then you have to ask yourself, what would I do differently, I personally? So if you're a lawyer, would you be more likely to offer pro bono services to the poor? Well, probably you would.
Mm.
Or a physician, would you be more likely? Let's suppose they suspended some of the malpractice stuff and all that. Would you be more likely to offer cut-rate services? Well, probably. But then the question becomes, well, then why aren't you doing that right now?
Mm.
And the answer is because you know you don't have to, because your moral responsibility is already being fulfilled on some other level. Now, that's not that doesn't satisfy by any means every demand we have to get to the bottom of what would happen to those people, but it's a start. And as a kind of empirical proof that there is something to that, in the 1960s, when it looked like the government was going to successfully take over the war on poverty that the free market had already been waging, we see that charitable donations fell substantially because people got the message, well, I already gave at the IRS, so why do I need to bother? But then in the 1980s, when people got the message that these programs were being cut back, they weren't, by the way. They're just their rate of growth was slowed, but they were still getting more money. But people got the message that these programs were being cut back. Charitable giving grew dramatically in the supposedly greedy 1980s.
Yep.
Actually, charitable giving grew dramatically. Wow. But we have also a lot of evidence of, here's this. I did some calculations for one of my books, and it turns out that when you factor in the inefficiencies and losses associated with collecting taxes, plus how much is eaten up by government welfare bureaucracies, it turns out that to get $1 to the poor, you have to give $5 to the government. So if the government were gone from
that
these things,
sense.
It's not like you wouldn't have to reproduce all that spending.
Yeah.
At most, it would be 20%, and these would be administered by organizations that don't get rewarded the more people need them.
That's what's amazing.
The more people they help.
Yeah, that's what's amazing is $4 of that $5 goes to running the bureaucracy, the machine that doles out that $1. It's incredible. Yeah.
Well, the other thing, I mean, as I read Real Descent, I kept on wondering, and I couldn't find anything specifically that you'd written online about this, but you know, when Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes, they were writing about the state of nature. I mean, these were guys who were living in Europe and really couldn't see what the state of nature was like. You know, they really had to guess what was life like before we had societies. And now we have much, much more of an idea. We had Jared Diamond on, who talked about his book, The World Until Yesterday. And part of what you find out is that, you know, these primitive tribes, they're constantly wiping each other out. You know, Steven Pinker has written in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, that before there were states that, you know, the level of violence against people was far, far greater. And so on the most basic level, right, the function of the state as Leviathan to have that monopoly on legitimate violence, which you reference, don't you think that's a positive function of the state?
I'm familiar with this thesis, but I think there is another way to think about it, because basically primitive societies are the way they are, in my opinion, not because they don't have states. They are the way they are because they, at least at that point in their evolution, don't have a fully developed tradition of private property, and as a result, they are extremely poor. And they don't have a division of labor, so they're basically all self-sufficient. And this incredible poverty and lack of a developed division of labor leads to constant warfare. And so it is, once you have private property come along, not the state necessarily, but private property and a division of labor where you see that it's mutually beneficial for me to exchange with people. Like, it's a good thing for me that you're around. You're not just somebody who's going to eat my corn. You're somebody who's going to plant more corn for me. This leads to a decline in the warfare that's being talked about in those books. So, I mean, the state wouldn't have the wealth to redistribute or the wealth to provide these security services in the first place if there weren't private property, productivity, markets, so that there would be enough wealth for the state to confiscate in the first place. So sometimes we have this view that civilization requires the state. But I think the state can't really exist without civilization, without a functioning society that creates the wealth that allows the state to exist in the first place.
There's no doubt about that, but I think one of the interesting things is that private property can't exist without the state. What you find when you look at these primitive tribes is that they don't have a clear defined concept of what land belongs to each group, and so what ends up...
Well, that requires a conflict resolution.
Exactly.
It requires... I mean, I heard a libertarian scholar, constitutional scholar, I think he was out of the Cato Institute. It wasn't David Boas, I can't remember his name, and he said... The our society is built on three principles that are so simple a kindergartner could understand them. One is don't take what doesn't belong to you. Two, keep your promises. And three, if you break the first two principles, you have to have make it right.
I know that you love that quote, Brian. But to go back to my point,
I was just saying you would need courts for that. You would need what you were saying is you would need something to enforce that private property.
And
right?
Yeah, and that's the point is that what you find in these primitive societies is that what enables that to be possible is that Leviathan. And I think, you know, I absolutely agree that, you know, there are places where the government is being involved where it's maybe not the best actor. But I think part of what's going to allow the libertarian movement to move forward, and I think that in light of new evidence, which I think is what you do so well, is to respond to that new evidence. You are a neoconservative, and then you respond to that new evidence, and you change your mind. I think that looking at what is the state of nature, based on what we now know from anthropology, from biology, from neuroscience, we may have to rethink the idea that we can simply live without governments in the same way that, you know, we have forgotten why that social contract was put in place. It's possible that we have really forgotten what that state of nature was truly like and therefore don't appreciate the positive functions that the state does play.
Okay, well, I mean, here, this is why I'm saying that this requires a whole separate, if you really want me to talk about how the evolution of law takes place in various societies, I mean, there are entire books on this. Mm. Bruce Benson, who's an outstanding historian and economist, has a book called The Enterprise of Law, where he shows how law evolves without the state, that it's actually just an interesting curiosity that we've come to associate law with the state, but it need not be associated that way. But secondly, I've already given my own account as to why it is that these societies are the way they are. It's not because of their lack of a state. But finally, I mean, moral arguments do matter. And I don't believe that there ought to be moral double standards, because I think people now have this kind of superstitious reverence toward the state, which is not modern at all, which is about as primitive as you could ask for, that we... I mean, even in the way we view the presidency, like, my gosh, everybody wants to know what his golf handicap is, or is he eating a slice of pineapple today? I mean, it's a weird cult around people who happen to possess power.
Yeah.
And, you know, people wonder, gosh, how did people ever go along with monarchs in the age of monarchy?
Idolatry.
Well, I just look at the trappings surrounding the U.S. president, whether it's Obama, it's Bush, it's Clinton, it's Reagan. It is a creepy, weird... almost religious devotion to these people, where people think, gosh, oh, where would I be without President so-and-so? Oh, my kids would be working in mines for 5 cents a day and getting their limbs blown off. There is nothing about that statement that is even remotely plausible or defensible. The reason your kids are not getting their limbs blown off anymore working in mines is not that the government wisely saved them from this. Children had been working since the beginning of time. What makes it possible for children to stop working? Passing some law? If it was that easy, they would have passed a law 1,000 years ago. If it was that easy, they'd pass a law in Bangladesh. Every time they try to do that in Bangladesh, the kids go into prostitution or they starve to death. What is it that makes it possible for kids to stop working?
Commerce.
Is that you create enough wealth in the society that the parents can afford to keep them home. Otherwise, if the kids don't work, the family starves. So, I mean, it's very easy to say, you know, where would we be without this or that institution, without stopping to think, where would we be without the market system? And then simply coming back and saying, well, you can't have the market system without the state. Well, that's not true. I mean, that's certainly not true. Anytime there's any exchange going on anywhere in the world, you have the market system.
Again, there's no doubt that there is this idolatry of the state and that it has gone far too far, right? But, you know, there's no doubt also that moral arguments are important. But we also have to remember that the Soviet Union made a moral argument for why redistribution of wealth was necessary. Like, people have competing moral goods, the idea that you should be able to keep your own property versus the idea that, you know, it's unfair for some people not to have enough. And the reason why the Soviet Union failed was because it was trying to act in opposition to human nature. And I think what has not really happened yet is that, you know, we now have far better insights into what human nature is from neuroscience and from psychology and from anthropology. And we really have to make sure that we are operating from the right assumptions about human nature. And I would encourage you. I think some of these books that are dealing with, you know, what is exactly the state of nature, who exactly are we on a biological level, I think they might be really informative.
I guess I still don't quite understand, though, no matter what my increased insights and whatever the value of these insights might be, I don't see the logic in saying, well, you know, human beings have good qualities and bad qualities, but probably the solution here is to give the guns and the right to expropriate over to the Jones family, and the rest of us will just, you know, occasionally the Jones family will let us decide which member of the Jones family can carry out the expropriating and the killing and whatever, and then this will yield us a good outcome. I'm not convinced of that. I to the contrary, I think all monopolies tend to be bad. I mean, why would we make an exception for this one monopoly?
Right.
A monopoly when it comes to the most important good of all, well, sure. But we can't have monopolies when it comes to shoes or whatever. Well, if we can't have a monopoly on the sale of shoes, I tend to be opposed to any sort of monopoly. But when you say that the libertarian movement, you know, if it's going to make progress, it's got to abandon this idea we can live without government, most libertarians agree with you.
Right.
So you don't have to have too much concern about the fate of the libertarian movement. Most of them agree with you. It is a sliver of us, but a growing sliver, who are willing to throw everything on the table and say, you know, I think it's utopian to expect government to stay limited when it has no interest whatsoever. There's no reason to expect that it would stay limited. I mean, look at the United States. It had a constitution that laid out limited government in a written form.
Yeah.
I mean, it had every possible advantage. It had no tradition of monarchy. It had none of a lot of the backward European inheritance. And it still is now a government that, I mean, the idea that you're ever going to limit this thing is utterly preposterous. So if the United States can't be limited, you know, what hope is there? So I am just inclined to think I want to be consistent. If I believe in something, I want to see, can this thing help to explain the world I live in? And is it plausible to think that monopoly is better than private property and individual rights?
It's utopian, certainly, to think that government will remain limited, but isn't it also possible to think that it's utopian that removing all government is going to create some perfect anarcho-capitalist society?
It would be, but I've never said that it would create a perfect anarcho-capitalist society. I don't think any society can be perfect. But what I would say is that some societies have fewer imperfections than others, and I think my society would be vastly wealthier because so much capital would not be squandered on basically lining the pockets of various fiefdoms that we call cabinet departments. I mean, for heaven's sake, if you look at 518 different agencies in the federal government doing heaven knows what, and each one of them we all know is full of dead wood. When they even on a state level in New York, when they asked how many bureaucrats work in the central office of the New York City education system, they found out it was 6,000 people. All right, well, maybe that's a little, maybe that's a lot, who knows, but you have to compare it to something. So they found out, well, how many people work in the Archdiocese of New York education system? Now, they educate 1/6 as many people, so they should have 1,000 bureaucrats. Turns out they had 26 bureaucrats.
Wow.
So this is reproduced all throughout the federal government. Every one of those people is going to fight tooth and nail to maintain that sinecure. It can't, I mean, this is a small minority, or a growing minority, that's for sure, tens of millions of people, living off the labor of others. Like, I don't want to glorify that as these are people who are day and night looking out for my well-being. If they were day and night looking out for my well-being, they wouldn't be intervening in the Middle East 24 hours a day. They wouldn't be saying, we're going to intervene in the Middle East, then stick our hands down your pants, and that's the way we're going to keep you safe. I don't believe these people do keep me safe. I think they put me in vastly greater danger.
I agree.
I love the way you think.
But I agree, and I 100% agree. And I think, listen, I mean, you know, the case that you're making about, you know, what U.S. foreign policy should be is incredibly strong. You'll get no disagreement from me on that. My question is just that, you know, I do wonder whether we fully appreciate what the positive functions of the state are. Not to say that all state functions of the state are positive, but what are the positive ones?
For example, what they did with discrimination. I mean, Tom, you got to admit that without, you know, if you were a black man living in 1945 Tennessee, you know,
I would be oppressed by a government. That's right.
Mm.
I would be oppressed by a government. So, yeah, I would want to get out from under that.
You were also given due course after a while. You were after a
while.
By
another government that had looked the other way at enslaving me for 100 years. Yeah, I mean, I would say a little bit too little too late there.
Okay.
And then secondly, I mean, there was so much that was done to try to undermine that on a voluntary level. The jitneys, I mean, it was really, really a sacrifice to engage in the bus boycott in Montgomery. I mean, how are these people? Taxis are very expensive. So they organized spontaneous jitney services to shuttle people around to their various lines of work. I mean, they figured ways out that eventually led to the collapse of those systems. I mean, I'm not going to make excuses for state. I mean, I'm not here to say state governments are awesome. It's just the federal government that's the problem.
Right.
They're all a bunch of sociopaths, if you ask me.
Well, well, you know, we had Matthew May on the podcast yesterday. He wrote a book called The Law of Subtraction and another
principle. In Pursuit of Elegance.
He talks about a guy, Hans Mondermann, who was an engineer, and he took an intersection in Holland, and he essentially took all traffic signals away from you know, took them all out, and he said, "Watch this now. I'm gonna." And there was pedestrians and bicyclists and motorcyclists and truck drivers and cars. And he said, "Watch how people don't need traffic signals. They figure their way out. They just know how to navigate something this complex." And he would put his hands over his eyes or behind his head and walk backward into traffic. And lo and behold, he didn't get hit because people weren't looking at traffic signs. They were looking at what was in front of them, and they were communicating with each other, and they didn't even need traffic signals. So I never would have believed that until we were talking about it. But so I do think there are a lot of examples where we think we need government because we've had it for so long.
There's no doubt about that. But I just, you know, and that's the point. I'm not saying that all government is good.
I
think the case is 100% great. But I just think that a large part of what we have to figure out is that, you know, governments were instituted among men, and there presumably was some sort of function, and I think we should try and understand.
Yeah, it was to exploit the public. I mean, if you look at the origins of most governments, it's not that people sat down and rationally deliberated and decided, you know, I think for the common good it would be best.
But Thomas Jefferson and George Washington,
okay,
and they would disagree.
That, I grant you, but that is very much an exception in the history of human affairs. One group conquered the other group, and then it's going to exploit the you-know-what out of the other group. I mean, that's really the origin of the state. It's not the state of nature, and then people come together and contract with each other. I mean, this is to make us feel good about the result, but I don't think it accurately describes, nor was it meant to accurately describe the result. Hobbes would be the first person to say that what he's describing never actually occurred.
But we do have the Bill of Rights, and we have the Constitution. And
that's true, and these things are going to be enforced and interpreted by the government itself.
Mm. But,
and so it's going to continue to find loopholes or, oh, you know what, we never discovered that. We never knew we could throw people in relocation camps, but apparently there it is in the Constitution. Well, wait a minute, it's not in my copy. Well, it doesn't matter because we have infallible interpreters of the Constitution, and it ain't you.
Mm. But
it's these special people.
Isn't the reason why that's fallen apart, though, because the people have fallen asleep? I mean, you know, Madison said that the best check on government power is always going to be the people. And I feel like that's where we've gone wrong, is that by and large, the people are asleep at the wheel.
Well, I agree with that. But on the other hand, you know, people have lives to live. Like, they shouldn't have to be spending all their time following what Ted Cruz or Nancy Pelosi is doing. Like, I used to blame them and say, yeah, wake up. And yeah, they probably should be more informed than they are. But for heaven's sake, this institution demands an awful lot of them, that they have to know monetary policy, they have to know foreign policy, they have to know things that the government won't even tell us about its own activities. I mean, this is too many demands for the average person.
So
I don't think we can blame them. If the Constitution made this situation that we're in possible, then it has failed. And it's easy to say, no, the people have failed. Well, whatever. I mean, you know, tomato, tomato. If this was possible under the Constitution, then the Constitution is responsible for this. It may have had the best of intentions with a lot of smart guys involved, but if it gave us this outcome, then it has to bear some of the blame.
Who are you voting for in the upcoming election, Thomas E. Woods?
I vote when I feel like it matters,
right.
And I've only once really felt like it mattered, and I voted for Ron Paul. But otherwise, I mean, I feel like it would be an insult to my intelligence to do this. It's a religious sacrament by which the government gains the consent of the population. And by and large, I choose not to participate in it.
Thomas E. Woods, you are a radical. I love it. I'd love to have you back. I promise to keep you only for 40 minutes, and that's what I'm going to do. But you are welcome back as many times as you like. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, the new podcast for Brian Callen is the Thomas Woods Show. Is it the Tom Woods or Thomas Woods?
It is the Tom Woods Show.
Tom Woods, baby. And
at tomwoods.com.
Yeah, no apologies. No apologies from this guy. It's unbelievable. We gotta have you back. So you let me know when you're free. We'll get in touch with you because I could talk about this stuff all day long.
And we do have 12 books to cover.
We do have 12 books.
That's right. Well, I appreciate it, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man.
Thank you, sir.
Really good stuff, man. We appreciate it. Thanks so much, man.
All right.
Bye-bye. Thomas E. Woods. That's a radical point of view. That's a radical point of view.
But I mean, I think that what I really appreciate about him, what you really get when you read Real Descent is that he is very thoughtful about all of these things.
Yes.
He has really thought through every single point and, you know, wants to have an intellectually and morally consistent point of view rather than what is politically expeditious.
Yeah. And I think it takes courage.
Absolutely.
One
of the things that I love that he said in there that is, I think, absolutely right on is the fact that, you know, at the time that being against slavery actually mattered in the 1830s, 1840s.
The government was complicit.
Well, no. Yeah. Only 2% of people voted for abolition parties.
Wow.
And yet everyone today tries to pretend, right, when being against slavery is the only obvious conclusion, that if they were alive in the 1830s or 40s, that they would have had the courage to stand up against slavery, you know? And how is it that you can be so interested in conformity and yet believe that you would have had the courage to stand up when it really mattered?
It's a really good question, man.
Yeah.
That's
it's not
really
my question. It's his question, but it's a really good question.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Hunter Motz. And that's why the kid is not just handsome. Your hair's looking very good, my friend. But
thank you, Brian.
The kid's got a brain.
I've been inspired by your hair transplants. And
damn it! Don't say it so loud.
Oh, that's not public.
My
knowledge.
Fans, my fans will freak
Brian,
out.
Brian, I don't think that they're your fans because of your hair.
Yes, they are. My hair is such a disaster. Okay, can't wait till they can clone hair. I'm going to have that hair. I'm going to drag you into the office.
And you just can take it?
Give me this. I don't have your Dutch bone structure, unfortunately.
Or my Dutch butt.
You got
my
tailpiece,
yeah.
You got a serious tailpiece.
Tailpiece, yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, on that note, go to briancallen.com. I got the Tempe Improv coming up. I think by the time this airs, I'll be hitting it.
Do you think you can start calling the 10-minute podcast instead of the TMP, the Tempe?
Yeah, I could do that.
Plug the show.
Tempe Improv, November 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th. Come see me.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.